Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Happy to be here as your host as we have conversations with colleagues in clinical psychopharmacology on topics that should be front of mind if they're not already front of mind. And we think about conundrums and what do you do in this situation or that situation? We try to think of clinical situations and scenarios where having expertise from an outside consultant can be really helpful. So Brain Trust brings you that outside expertise. And today will be no exception to our format and our formula. We have with us today my longtime friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Ostacher. Let me introduce Michael. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and site director for the Addiction Medicine Fellowship at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. He's on the faculty at Stanford University. Michael began his professional research life in the mood disorders world, if that's fair to say. I've known him for a long time in that realm. And then he evolved into the substance use world, which is an occupational hazard when you do work in mood disorders, because I guess, as he'll tell us, there's a high co-occurrence between mood disorders and substance use disorders. And for those of us who are clinicians or researchers or both, we struggle with how to disentangle the interactions and interplays between problems that stem from substance use and problems that stem from mood and the interplay. So, Michael, first, welcome. And second, is that a fair intro?
Perfect. Wonderful.
Well, take it away, Michael. Enlighten us on the things I just said. Give us your wisdom.
All right. Wonderful. I'm so glad you're here. I probably should acknowledge the people who have been important to me in my career to get me to where I am. So Andy Nierenberg is really the person who took me from my clinical career, which was working in the community. I was a medical director. I got an MPH in healthcare management, and I was doing these things. And Andy brought me to Mass General in about the year 2000 to study bipolar disorder. And so that was really, really important thing for me. But I've always been interested in sort of the co-occurrence of substance use disorders and psychiatric illnesses, whether they were mood disorders or anxiety disorders or psychotic disorders. And it's really important to acknowledge that I think I had really good teachers doing this, including someone named Ken Minkoff. I don't know if any of you know Ken, but he's really important in the kind of dual diagnosis world. How do we make sure that our patients who have substance use disorders and, you know, and addictions and psychiatric illnesses get the care that they need? And he was really, really important to me, because the perspective you have in mental health is really often one where we're trying to sort of advise people and to prescribe for them, and we provide therapy for them. And it's a very different from the addictions world, I think, where in the addictions world, the locus of control is really in the person who has the addiction. And so it's a very different perspective. Like, telling people what to do when they have an addiction doesn't generally work so well, right? Because most of the people who come to treatment for us, for example, they know they have a problem. They may not admit it out loud, you know, but they know that their substance use is interfering with their relationships. It's making their symptoms worse. You know, at the least, you know, people who are drinking, they're waking up hungover, they're irritable, whatever, you know, all these different things. So telling them that they should stop using substances doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really work very well, right? Whereas, like, if somebody comes in and they have sleep problems, I have no problem telling people, well, you know, what we know is you should not read in bed or watch TV in bed, right? You should get, mm-hmm. you should like set the same sleep time. And, you know, so giving advice to people or instructions to people works really well in lots of areas of what we do. With substance use disorders, you know, telling somebody you need to drink less or you're drinking too much, that often doesn't go over very well. And the reason it doesn't go over very well is because those people have already been trying to do that for many years. So it's kind of like, tell me something I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, like, being a practitioner, being in a place where I can just listen to people and understand where they are and listen to them and try to get them to express what things they might want to change, it's a very different perspective, I think, from what I learned. The other thing that Ken taught me was, I mean, he was so, we would have supervision in his car sometimes, which was great. We'd drive around Boston going to these different hospitals, and Ken would give me his wisdom. And one of the most important pieces that he gave me was this notion about what it means to have expertise in treating addictions and mental illness. And he said, I can understand why there's child psychiatry training, right? Because, like, not all of us are going to treat kids, right? Most of us just treat adults. And I can understand why there's geriatric psychiatry training, he would say, because, not all of us treat the very old, right? He said, but I don't understand why there's specialty training in addictions, because all of us treat people who have addictions. And that, unless you're completely screening people with substance use disorders out of your practice, which is probably not a great endeavor to get involved in, you're going to be treating people who have substance use disorders. And either they're going to be willing to tell you that they have a problem with drugs or alcohol or some other sort of addiction, whether it's gambling or sex or some other thing, or currently now, not being able to get off their phones, for example. They may not tell you that they have the problem, but you, if you're practicing in the mental health sphere, you're going to see people who have addiction problems. So, like, how do you then kind of address this? And I think for
One point
me,
you sorry, one point you're making, you're not here to judge. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm on your side. Is that fair?
I think so. I mean, I tend to be pretty down to earth with my patients, but I don't know. I mean, I don't want people to tell me what I can and can't do when I go home at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from with this. At the empathy, I suppose, means I fully appreciate the struggle, and I'm not going to say something that might almost sound patronizing by saying, you really are causing trouble to yourself when you do this. Like you say, tell me something I don't already know. Rather, I guess the trick here would be how to sneak up with the empathy, like, boy, this thing is mightier than you, and it's eating you alive, and that's just unacceptable. And we have to figure out some way to help
Yeah,
you, right?
I mean, I think it's even more like, tell me why you're here, and tell me what's going on with you, and let me try to be a person who you're not going to feel criticized and judged by. And I think being able to have a relationship with our patients over time that allows them to be who they are with us as much as they're able to, I think is really important.
A colleague of mine who writes in this area talks about shame, which you just
Yeah.
said makes me wonder if that is important to acknowledge that one of the reasons why you may not want to feel forthcoming isn't just judgy, but if there's a sense of shame. I mean, I have this thing that I do behaviorally, chemically, and it makes me feel bad about myself. I already feel bad about myself.
Yeah, I think that that's I think that's really true, and I think also people bring their own experiences in healthcare systems, with authority, with their friends and family, and people are often criticized for their behavior. So they might not want to tell you about something because they're afraid that you're going to criticize them in the same way. And this is not to say that those criticisms from family or work or whatever are not valid. They are, right? Like, if you're not being present as a partner, as a parent, as an employee, as a friend, because your substance use is getting or your addiction is getting in the way, yeah, that's a real problem. But if you're trying to help somebody, it's really important to sort of step out of the way of those kind of judgments, because people will then just not want to tell you what's really going on with them. And it may take people many years to overcome their expectations of being judged or their own feelings of stigma about things. I mean, stigma is a complicated thing. Stigma is a complicated thing. I teach undergraduate course in addictions at Stanford. We've done it for almost 10 years now. The main purpose of the class originally was to destigmatize people who use substances. Okay, well, now I teach the class, and none of the students have stigma against people who use drugs. Like, the culture has changed. But that doesn't mean that stigma isn't necessarily a bad thing. For example, smoking. If you ask a group of people whether or not they think smoking is good or bad, like use those judgmental terms, people will raise their hands and say, bad. Smoking's bad. And like, yeah, smoking's bad. It is bad. And that's why it's a really good idea not to start. And that's why the rates of initiation of smoking in young people in the United States is really vanishingly small compared to the way it was when I grew up, where we used to smoke all the time and smoke in college, in class with our teachers. So it's like this is not happening anymore. But self-stigma, like shame, worrying about those are really important things for clinicians to take into consideration when they're treating their patients, because they will, because if your patients will bring with them all their experiences and their expectations of you. And I think it's really important if we're going to help people globally to be in a position with them where they can feel trusting towards us, that we're not going to shame them or reject them for their patients.
Understood, of course. Now, if I can ask a real fundamental question, the proverbial chicken and egg question. You've got a mood problem, say depression, and you've got substance use. And they can interact in such a way as to make each other worse. You can have two problems, or you could take the alternative route and say, well, I have one problem, and the other is an attempt to solve it. So, let's take the Kantian model of self-medication. If only my depression were better, I wouldn't have an addiction. The implication there is fix my mood, and then my addiction will melt away. Can you speak to the implications and veracity or lack thereof of that?
This is really important. Ed Kantzman was one of my important teachers. I was at Cambridge Hospital when he was there, and I worked with him when I was well, later ran was a unit director at a state hospital in Tewkesbury, Massachusetts. And Ed was the associate director of psychiatry there. And so I worked with him for many years, and I think what Ed did that's really important is to have empathy for people's experiences. And I think that that's really important for all of us to appreciate. What I don't think that Ed did was really demonstrate that there is a relationship between people's feelings and whether or not they use drugs or alcohol. I mean, I think understanding people's, like, Ed had this ego psychology view of how people were treating their inner selves using drugs. And I think that's really important from an empathy perspective. But I don't know if the chicken or egg is really important. What we know epidemiologically is that several things. One is that most people who develop mental illnesses in their lifetime develop them in their adolescence, right? Early adulthood. They're young when they develop them. And people who develop substance problems develop them when they're young. And so which came first? Like anxiety, depression, relationship problems that arise from a mental health disorder? Or do people develop these because they have substance problems? I mean, I'm not sure it's even worth sort of parsing that out. And that's probably even more true when it comes to trying to decide whether or not to treat people. Now, for certain diagnoses, right? And for me, like, severe bipolar disorder, bipolar 1 disorder, schizophrenia, you really should know whether or not the person has a mental illness or whether or not they have a substance-induced condition that will go away when they stop using their substances. And I think those are important. But most of the time when we see people, we're not, unless we're seeing people in an emergency setting, we're not necessarily seeing people who are in that either-or place. Most of the people that we see have persistent, ongoing problems with mental health symptoms and substance problems at the same time.
I would
And
agree,
so
but may I ask the contrarian question, not to interrupt, but when people sort of invoke, I'm self-medicating, is there something sort of colluding with denial around that? As if to say, look, Addictions are disorders of the reward pathway in the brain. There's something broken in your nucleus accumbens, and that's its own thing. And you may very well identify your use of a substance or a behavior as a way to try to compensate for that. If you want to call it self-medication, you could do that. It's just, let's be clear, addictions are their own diseases. I wonder if you struggle with the psychology of self-medication as a concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Many people know Roger Weiss and McLean, who's done a lot of work in this area. And he was also one of my supervisors and colleagues. He said, when a patient comes in and they say they're self-medicating, he said they're pre-contemplative. People mean pre-contemplative. They're
Fascinating.
not ready to change, right? Everybody has a story about why they use. And I think, for us, people come for help. I mean, some people come and they just want to be listened to, and I understand that. But if people want help, we have to find a way to work our way in with them. And if somebody comes in with a narrative that says, I'm self-medicating, and they're sort of putting a barrier up to their having their problem solved, because the story is, you don't understand, I need to use drugs and alcohol to feel better because I have this fundamental problem that can only be treated by the things I'm doing to treat them, meaning, cannabis or drinking or, whatever the substance or behavior is that they're engaging in. And I think we have to just like be patient with people, I think. I mean, and I think, if people come in with that, I think it's a bit of a, I don't know if defensive is the right word, but it's a narrative that people have. They have a story that explains their behavior. Well, okay, it's okay. I mean, I understand that that's why you're using it. Like, what are the things that your use does that affect you, right? In both positive and negative ways, right? And trying to get people to have more sense within themselves of the reasons that they're both using and the reasons that they might not want to, and to see whether or not their decisions about choosing to continue to use drugs and alcohol or not, is made with more information.
I fully get the concept that you would tread lightly on someone's narrative and not necessarily, especially early on, for want of a better word, challenge that in order to build the rapport and the trust and the alliance. But at the same time, I'm thinking, like, as the psychopharmacologist, when I hear I'm self-medicating, maybe you can help me here. In my head, I'm thinking, oh, I'm not doing enough aggressively to blast the dickens out of your depression. I better pull out the 16-inch guns of
Right, right,
depression
right,
treatment.
right, 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 right. Well, and I think that that's
Help
often what
me.
people want you to do, right? You fix my depression, doc, and my behavior will change. Well, I mean, okay. I mean, I think, look, if we're just talking about depression, and we're talking about depression and substances, the evidence, for example, for treating people's depression while they're using substances isn't terrific. Right. So the effect of antidepressants, for example, in people who have depression who are drinking, just overall tend to be lower. And at the same time, we tend to think that the people who come who drink or use drugs and have a mental illness, mood disorder, are the ones who aren't going to get better. But it turns out that it's not necessarily true. So on the one hand, giving people depression medicine isn't necessarily going to fix the underlying depression and then lead to a change in their drinking behavior. But the people who we think are going to end up with the worst outcomes, turns out in the data, don't necessarily work out that way. In fact, in bipolar disorder, certainly, and I published about this, the people who have substance use disorders are much more likely to get better, and more likely to get better more quickly than the people who don't have a substance use disorder and bipolar disorder. So why would that be? Well, there are several reasons. One is, unless people are being forced into treatment, they're coming because they want help. Right? I mean, they're coming because they're, as we say, they're not having a great day. So they're coming to treatment and they're in a bad spot. The people who have substance use disorders tend to mitigate their use as they enter treatment. This is no bigger a problem than if you try to study this stuff, right? Think, oh, The comorbidity of lifetime comorbidity of substance use disorders and bipolar disorders, like 60% for bipolar 1 disorder, is probably just about as high for bipolar 2 disorder, and it's nearly as high for all the other things we treat, generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, whatever. They're all like, it's very high. So you think, oh, this is great. I'm going to be able to study this. People are going to come in. They're going to have these problems. I'm going to study it. The people who, you recruit people for a study, and they come in and they're like, yeah, I saw your study. I have a drinking problem. I have bipolar disorder. I really want help with this. Like, how much are you drinking? Oh, I stopped drinking. I'm like, you did what? I'm like, yeah, I like you stopped drinking. I'm like, well, that's great. And I'm really glad that you stopped drinking, but you're not eligible for my study because you have to be drinking to be in my study. And so, like, the people who seek treatment tend to get better. And so the people with who seek treatment who have a comorbid psychiatric disorder and substance use disorder as a whole are motivated to get better
So
and motivated.
what do you say to the clinician who's meeting that patient, not in a research setting, but clinically, and they're forthcoming and they let you know, well, I'm doing a pint of vodka every night, and I'm depressed. And the clinician is, I guess, thinking, I'm not going to be able to make much in the way of inroads for your mood with the neurotoxicity of your alcohol. So, in your head, you think to yourself, we need to get you abstinent, if not sober, as a prerequisite to be able to get at your mood. At least I've had those thoughts in my
Yeah, of
head.
course. Yeah, of course. And I think that's, I mean, I think when I did my training, that was literally the rule, right? You could not get into the outpatient clinic where I trained for the treatment of depression until you were sober. So we would like screen people, we'd do these intakes, and like the best intake was somebody who was still drinking, because you could say, come back in 6 months when you're not drinking, and then we'll treat your depression. And then, that's a terrible thing to do.
Yeah, obviously.
I mean, it's just a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing to do. I mean, what do you do? I mean, I think you can do several things, right? So, like in the primary care world, they do screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, right? So ESPRT, right? So this is really just about educating people. So there are some people who may not know that their drinking is hazardous. I literally had a conversation in the addiction clinic where I work with a patient who was there for treatment of his alcohol use disorder. And the addiction medicine fellow, said to me, well, he's having 2 drinks a day. And I'm like, well, what's he drinking? And she said, he's drinking these drinks. They're called Cutwaters. They have 13% alcohol and they're 15 ounces or whatever it is. And I said, oh yeah, and how much is he drinking? He says, well, he has 2 cans of those. Well, those are 6 drinks, right? Because each one of those is free standard drink. So I said to him, so this is how much alcohol you're drinking. So even though you're drinking 2 cans, it's really 6 drinks. And for men, if they drink 5 or more drinks a day, it's considered hazardous drinking. He said, what? And I said, yeah, it's considered hazardous drinking if you're drinking more than when you're drinking 5 or more drinks in a day. And he said, I didn't know that. And I think sometimes just telling people where they're drinking is a helpful thing to do. But yeah, you have to be able to have the beginning of a conversation,
What
because
if it's matter of fact, like the cardiologist or the pulmonologist who's treating, COPD or congestive heart failure, and the fellow smokes cigarettes? I mean, you wouldn't tiptoe. You'd say, look, we're the forces at play here are at cross purposes. Your nicotine and your combustion of nicotine is at variance with my efforts to help your heart. So we have a problem.
I think you could do it in a shared way like that. You could also say, you know that smoking is harmful to you. Are you interested in having a discussion about changing your smoking? Or can we talk about your smoking? Yes. Yes or no? Like, I get a lot of no's. I get a lot of, yeah, I know, and I'm not ready to do anything about it, or I'm not, I'm just going to keep things where they are, doc. Like, it's just, I'm not going to be able to do anything about that. Okay.
But can you fix my mood meantime?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I think that that's a real thing that we have to struggle with, right? We have to struggle with our own, I don't know, power, whatever,
Yes.
right? And
Powerlessness.
I think a lot of people worry about their liability and responsibility, right? And so if somebody continues to engage in a behavior that's harmful, am I responsible for that in some way? I mean, I think, I do studies with in hepatology. And so I'm the addiction expert in these trials of people with alcohol-related liver disease. The hepatologists are awesome. They're doing the same thing that I said to the patient, right? They're saying your drinking is hazardous. If you continue to drink, your liver disease will progress to cirrhosis, or you have cirrhosis and your liver disease will continue to progress and you'll develop liver failure. Would you like to do something about your drinking? And so, I mean, I think giving people information about their health and asking them what they want to do is, I think,
Empowering.
fine. Yeah.
Well, locus of control, right? I mean, you can choose to ride a motorcycle without a helmet. I'm here to give you some statistics. Do with that information as you wish. I mean, could that be one?
Hey, for all of us who watch The Pit, Dr. Robbie doesn't wear a helmet. All right. And so he knows that people come in with smashed gourds, and I don't know how the season's going to end up, but
Yeah.
like he's not wearing a helmet right now. It's how the show starts. He's driving into work without a helmet. So you can give people all the information you want, and they have to make a decision about how they're going to use it. If
But
somebody says, right, no, but I think to get to your point, if somebody says, you need to fix my depression, I'm not doing anything about my drinking, you can say that puts me in a very difficult spot. And the thing that I really wanted to get to in this conversation was the question about treatments for addiction in people who have mood disorders, right? And so treating mood disorders while people have addictions is a big struggle. It's more of a struggle, I think, probably for depression than it is, for example, for bipolar disorder, where I think the bipolar disorder treatments still work, certainly to prevent mania. The problem with people who have substances in their lives is they tend not to be very good about taking care of themselves, and that includes not very good about being adherent to their medications and taking them as prescribed, right? So they miss a lot of doses and they're not really engaged as much, and that's a real risk. But I think it's really important that if you have people who have mood disorders and substance use disorders, that they're getting the evidence-based treatment for their substance use disorders at the same time. And so I would like send a message out to people that I would hope that they would learn about those different medications for addiction treatment while they're treating their patients so that they can offer them to those patients too, right? And that starts on many levels, right? So I don't think that refer, you know, it's okay to refer people out for smoking cessation, but I think it's really important given that the leading cause of increased mortality in people with mental health conditions that's changeable probably today is smoking. It's changing because fewer people are smoking. It's smoking and obesity, for example, are the two things that we need to be able to treat people for. So we should treat people for smoking. Well, there are lots of medications that work for smoking. So.
Could I ask you about an intervening variable question? Our friend and colleague Joe Calabrese some years ago published a paper looking at substance use comorbidity and bipolar disorder and made the interesting argument, if I remember correctly, that comorbid substance use actually amplified poor adherence to the psychotropic regimen for bipolar disorder more so than a direct toxic effect of the substances. I forget how he showed that, but I remember him publishing.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't be
I'm not
surprised.
sure I agree with that, but I just wanted to ask you for a comment on that.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think there are two things about the epidemiology and the course of things. The two times when people are at most the time when people are at most risk for two different things are when they're young, right? So, like when people are young, especially people with bipolar disorder, they don't want to have that diagnosis, and they may think, you know what? I was just like partying too much or stressed out or like working too hard, and I don't really have bipolar disorder, and I really didn't get psychotic because I have bipolar disorder. I was just stressed, and I don't know, I'm not really sick. And so those people don't take their medications. And then the other thing is, in that group of people who are young, is that they tend to have, that tends to be the time when they have substance problems the most, whether it's drinking or drugs. And so, so direct toxic effect is probably, it's somewhat important, but like not engaging in treatment for bipolar disorder is a real problem, right? Getting people to take their medications and not decide, you know what, I really don't need this anymore, is one of the most important things that we can do.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying. For a fair number of individuals who present with mood and substance use problems, very often there may well be two diagnoses, and to try to split hairs and parse which came first or which is more important than the other is missing the big picture. And this individual in front of you is now staring down at a more ominous ailment that involves like two heads that both have to be addressed at the same time. And to just go down one pathway or the other is probably going to be a disservice as compared to saying you've got two formidable, it's like you have diabetes and hypertension and they can correlate, but fixing one ain't going to fix the other necessarily. We have to really roll up our sleeves. Is that a fair thing to say?
I mean, I think it's, yes, and I think, I mean, you're a really good communicator, and you're caring for patients, and you're caring for your colleagues. I mean, it just comes out when you talk to you. So like, you bring yourself to your relationship with your patients.
That's
I mean,
exactly.
I think it's good to tell people that you have this, two-headed monster that you need to address. I think that's important. I think probably the most important thing is to get people to be cognizant and accepting that they have a condition that would benefit from treatment, right? And so how do you get people to do that, right? I mean, if you work with young people, right? You work with college students. When they get manic, they go on medical leave, right? They've scared the hell out of their classmates, out of their dorm mates, out of their RAs on their hall. And deans are pretty good about letting people take leave and coming back, right? And it takes some work to get people to reintegrate, right? They're not so great if you have a second manic episode and you like take somebody hostage in the library or something like that, or you like do something that really scares people. They're not so good about letting you come back after that. And I think, you have to find a way to talk to people about like, maybe it's worth considering whether or not for a while we should continue to have you take your treatment, even if you're not sure that you have bipolar disorder, because the risk of having another episode like your last one in terms of its effect on your life is really high. And the risk of staying on the medications, well, that's something that you need to sort out for yourself. When you're doing substances and mental illness together, it's obviously harder. And if telling people, we have these two things that we need to address at the same time is a way to engage people, I think that's great. I think it's important to do that. At the
How do
same
you
time, go ahead.
reconcile, so with all respect to Joe Calabrese's observation that it's really the adherence issue that the substances flag, which may or may not be a thing, the fact that our treatments for bipolar disorder, our treatments for major depression, our treatments for schizophrenia don't work as well when you have a substance use disorder, and so we psychopharmacology people tear what's left of our hair out, thinking, well, what should I use? I mean, lithium's not as effective in the setting of substance use. I can certainly try it. There's that lovely old study from Ihssane Salim with valproic acid. Remember that one?
Right.
Bipolar.
Ursuline, yes.
Want to say a word on that one? Because that's one of the few, when I talk on this topic myself, that's one of the few, I won't say shining moments, but examples where I can say, here's a little glimmer of something that could help.
Yeah, I mean, this is an area that's really been a struggle for me because I wanted that to be my career, right? Treatments for substance use disorders in people with bipolar disorder. I mean, I've already talked about like how hard it is to recruit people because they tend to get better before you enroll them. And so It's very hard to show a drug placebo difference if people have already improved. But yeah, I don't know whether or not the treatments for bipolar disorder don't work as well if people have substance problems. I think that the group of people who have substance problems have a worse course. That's true in life. If you look in studies like STEP-BD or the Stanley Foundation studies, it's actually not true that the people who have substance use disorders do better than the people who don't. That's probably because their substance use disorders are getting better while they're in these studies. And so I don't know whether or not that it's true that that's the case. What is important, though, is that we have for decades tried to find treatments that are specifically effective for people who specifically have bipolar disorder and a substance use disorder. And we've, other than Esansalem's study, which is small, I think it's 60 total subjects,
Yeah, 30-30.
we've really been unable to find treatments that work specifically in that group. So what does that mean? We don't treat them? No. I think what it means is that we make the assumption that strongly effective treatments for substance use disorders should be given to people who have bipolar disorder. And so the top of that list, I think, from prevalence perspective, is treatments for smoking cessation. So we should be giving, if they fail, oral and patch nicotine, right? So nicotine replacement therapy, and you give them a patch and you give them some oral replacement, whether it's gum or lozenges, and they don't do well, you really should consider giving people varenicline. It is clearly effective. And the impact on mortality and morbidity, if you get people to stop smoking, is really important. And the second one is opiate use disorders. Not as prevalent, but the treatments, there's no evidence that the treatment with methadone or buprenorphine for an opiate use disorder does not work as well in people who have bipolar disorder. Now, the people with bipolar disorder may not be adherent, but there are ways around that. We have long-acting injectable buprenorphine, that's subcutaneous treatment. A couple different manufacturers make them. They work really well. And if you have a serious adherence problem with somebody, I think they're a reasonable thing to do. Those are life-saving treatments. The smoking cessation treatment, the opiate use disorder treatments, we shouldn't wait for there to be a definitive study. There have been studies of varenicline in bipolar disorder, and it works really well.
Roy Changapa's study in the Journal of
Yeah, and
Psychiatry.
Rob Antonelli did a big study with Pfizer looking at varenicline in 8,000 people, for like 4,100 who have mental illnesses, and in that subgroup of people with bipolar disorder, and it clearly is effective compared to placebo. In fact, placebo numerically was not as good, it was better, excuse me, than nicotine replacement, although they only used the patch. They didn't use dual therapy, which should be the standard for people. But those are the two things. It's absolutely, there's no argument from my perspective that we should wait for better studies in bipolar disorder to give people those treatments. For opiate use disorder, smoking, we should treat people right away. For alcohol, I think we have a number of FDA-approved treatments and some that are off-label that probably are helpful in people no matter what their mental health condition is. So giving people naltrexone, whether oral or long-acting injectable, is a really smart idea.
Do you think we're underusing that? I mean, do you think
Huh.
as we're speaking to
Make me
however many
laugh.
thousands of viewers
Make
today?
me laugh. Make me laugh. So, like,
No,
okay, so
my
that drug
question
doesn't
is.
work. So let's say it works for 30% of people or something like that. Or you're like, whatever it is. Or like, let's say there's some like small reduction. I don't know what the number needed to treat is, but like, let's say there's some impact. There's some. It's clear. The meta-analyses show that it's true. Cochrane says naltrexone and acamprosate, they're both effective for treating people who have alcohol use disorder. Yeah, just I think, yeah, we just give it to them.
Do you want to go out on a limb here and now and encourage our colleagues? If you're treating a mood disorder patient with alcohol use disorder, just as you, if you're treating a smoker, you should be bringing up varenicline. If they have an alcohol use disorder, you should be proactively bringing up.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. No, I will, it's not, yes, I will go out on a limb. If you have a patient who has an alcohol use disorder diagnosis, you should offer them medications for treatment. They're welcome to not take them, but you should offer them for treatment. We did a study at Stanford Hospital of people who had an alcohol use disorder diagnosis in their record made at the time of their hospitalization for whatever other condition. And the percentage of people who got discharged from the hospital on a medication was something around 2%. So 1 in 50 people admitted with an alcohol use disorder got discharged on a medication approved for the treatment of alcohol use disorder or known to be effective. And that included drugs that I will never use for alcohol use disorder, like gabapentin, but also topiramate. So like 2%. So
STEP-ED
we
also
did it.
found, as I remember, in STEP-ED,
Yes.
we found, we were both on STEP-ED, I think we found a
0.4%.
remarkably low rate of, substance use disorder pharmacologies being offered to bipolar patients.
It's 20 years ago, but 4%, 0.4% of people eligible for medications were receiving them.
We
So,
can do better.
life of lifetime. And I think it's really important that we, those are the ones that we have to. We do not have medications for cannabis use disorder. We do not have medications really for stimulant use disorder. Some people use long-acting injectable naltrexone and high-dose bupropion, Wellbutrin, bupropion. And there's a study, it's just not that great for stimulant for methamphetamine use disorder. But for alcohol, tobacco, opiate use disorder, these people need to be offered treatment if they're willing to take it. And I think we have an obligation to do that. And I think we're smoking a moral obligation
I think
to.
what you just said is one of the more weighty comments I've heard in this whole series of give, we're not here to give advice, folks, but here's some advice. Yeah, I mean, ask your patients. At the very least, bring it up. Give them the statistics. Tell them, you have a two-headed monster, but there's things we can do about it. And this is instilling not just hope, but agency, right?
And don't think that it's not your responsibility to learn about it. And don't think that it's not your place to give people these treatments. They're still your patients. You're treating them and they have this problem. Go ahead, treat them for the problem while you're treating them. It makes sense to do that. I don't think we should be afraid of addiction medications. I don't think we should be afraid of taking care of those things in our patients because they're in our offices anyway.
It's
And
part of good general practice.
we can really help people's outcomes.
Wow.
GLP-1s, we'll know more in a year or two.
I was going to ask you about that. What do you think? What do you think?
I think
Alcohol?
we should study them more. We're doing a study now, FDA registration trial starting at the VA, led by Dave Ostlin in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so, of GLP-1s, of semaglutide versus placebo for alcohol use disorder, it should be a definitive trial. But I'm fairly certain that they will work for alcohol. For other substances, not so sure. But for any, if you give GLP-1s to rodents, they will drink less alcohol. They will also drink less water. And so these drugs decrease people's ingestion of things. So it's likely to be helpful, diagnosis aside.
And there's probably a lot of, we haven't talked about this, but there's probably a lot of poly substance use disorder in these populations too, right? So if I could make inroads, is it fair if I could make inroads in your alcohol or your something, maybe that will alter the comprehensive system just a little bit?
Well, people that take better care of themselves take better care of themselves. We did get rid of polysubstance use disorder
I know.
diagnoses in DSM-5 for better or for worse. We look at them individually
They
now.
only exist in reality.
They only exist in reality. But I think it's, I think to go back to what I said at the beginning, Ken Minkoff said we shouldn't have a subspecialty in addictions because our patients have addictions. And so I think you guys should feel confident in approaching your patient with addictions. Learn some basic things about how to approach smoking cessation, how to refer for opiate use disorder treatment or to initiate it yourself, and how to treat people who have alcohol use disorders. I think those are really important to do.
Amen. Michael, this has been so helpful. I hope our viewers and listeners will walk away from this, not just saying, oh, that was an interesting conversation, but wow, I really want to think differently about my own patients. And maybe I won't agonize in so dogmatic a way as to, look, you're not treating your this, so I can't treat your that, but rather I've got to be part of the team that's addressing both. And that 0.4%, it deserves underscoring. If
Right.
we're
Even
not
if it's
proactive,
5%, even if it's 5%, it's too low. We should be in a place where we feel comfortable treating our patients because they're in our offices,
yeah.
and
And
we're in a perfect position to do this.
if it's not the mental health prescribers who are at the very least initiating the dialogue and bringing it up and putting it into play, and take all those pre-contemplative people and say, file this away. We'll come back to it. Important topics come back again and again. We could save lives.
Don't be afraid. Thanks for inviting me.
Great wisdom as always. Michael, Dr. Ostacher, thank you so much for joining us. I really, really, truly appreciate everything you've had to say. Words of wisdom. I hope you all found this as helpful as I know I did. And I have goosebumps. So thank you again.
Nice to see you all.
We'll look forward to seeing you back again real soon on the next edition
Right,
of
take
Brain
care.
Trust Conversations in Clinical Psychopharmacology.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.